Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey everybody, welcome back. I'm so excited to be back to the traditional episodes. So, first news. Okay, there will be a Light in the Dark Tour Part 2 2026, all right? And like last year, it will be in September in conjunction with the Mothman Festival in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. So this year, the Mothman Festival is going to be on Saturday and Sunday, September 19th and 20th. So my tour will actually be the week leading up to that, culminating in my appearance at the Mothman Festival, where I'll do a live talk about the writing and the making of the movie, just like last year. And then later on Saturday night, a special private ticketed event, the Richard Haddams Paranormal Bookshelf live performance, which will end up being the last show of the tour. Last year it was the first show, but this year it will be the last show. So here are the cities we will be visiting this time for the Light in the Dark Tour Part 2. Here are the cities. Get out your pencils. Toronto, which I like to call Toronto, with a ch. Toronto, Minneapolis, Chicago, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh. And then, of course, Point Pleasant, West Virginia at the Mothman Festival. So once again, we'll be visiting Toronto, Minneapolis, Chicago, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh. These are some of my biggest cities. I can't wait to meet these people. Now, we don't have the exact dates yet because we're still locking down locations, but that's where we will be sometime between Saturday, September 12th and Saturday, September 19th. So clear your schedules for that week, all right? And come to see me. There's going to be more details as soon as we have them. And if you're in one of those cities and you have the perfect, cool, creepy location, a bookstore, a haunted house that can be rented by the night for events, or any place you think might work, shoot me an email and let me know about it, because we're still figuring out exactly where we're going to be. Okay, more to come. Now, you know, I typically don't talk directly about the book in the episode, or anything about the episode at all, really, when I'm doing the introduction, but this one, there was a synchronicity going on. I had always intended to write about the book This House is Haunted. It's a book that's been on my paranormal bookshelf for a long time. But it really was coincidental that this episode, which ended up being about the first year that we spent in the house on Rosita Lane in Pasadena, it was largely written as we were packing up to leave after 19 years. And it was incredibly emotional going through 19 years of life and either selling it or giving it away or packing it away. And everything you're touching is connected to a memory, and it can be hard. So here's what I've learned. I'm actually not as devoted to things as I thought I was, or as I thought I would be. I got into the mode that was like seriously, let's just throw everything away and burn it. Now, I didn't do that, but I got rid of more things than I thought I would, which is because I had to. We were moving into a house about half the size of the one we were in, so there was no way all the books were going to go with me. And another thing I discovered is that collecting modern first editions from the last 40 years is not a great investment if you're looking at it from a purely financial standpoint. Simply owning a fine copy of a first edition from a major author in the last 40 years is essentially worth nothing. That's what I found out. If it's signed, that's different. But just the book, even by major authors, Stephen King, if you're talking popular, or people like Toni Morrison on the literary end, or Larry McMurtry on the middle end, or Anne Rice, or Barbara Kingsolver, or Walter Mosley, or James Lee Burke, just the book, a hardcover first edition, I'm telling you, you can buy them online for about $5, which, you know, is cool if you want to collect them, but if you're trying to sell them, not so cool. So a lot of those books I had to say goodbye to, but I kept pretty much everything from my paranormal bookshelf because they are rare. And In many cases, they're also signed, so those have personal value and monetary value. And things like the John Keel first editions, which are pretty rare, but the fact that they're inscribed to me personally, those are priceless. So anyway, I had to make some hard decisions on what to say goodbye to after decades of owning something, a book, or really anything. Here's the thing. Do you need the thing to keep the memory? No, you do not. Thank God. You feel like you do, but you don't. Your whole house does not have to be a living scrapbook to every minute of your entire existence. Susan is very good at helping other people get rid of their stuff. And she taught me you pick something up, you thank it for its service, and then you move it along to someone else who might need it or want it. And she's right. But luckily, I know from experience that once I'm out of a place, I'm fine. And I'm happy to be in the new place. And all the old places I've ever been in, because I've only lived here in Los Angeles, I drive by them all the time. And you know what? I still own them. I was there. A chunk of my life was there. So I own them. I say hi. I check on them. I see what they've done. Maybe they've put on a new coat of paint. Maybe they've cleaned their front yard. And I don't feel like I've lost them. And they're still with me as much as I need them to be. So wherever you are and whatever house you're in right now, love it. Touch the walls. Feed the plants in the backyard. Look out the windows and really inhabit it at least once every day. And don't worry about those weird noises it makes in the middle of the night. It's nothing, I'm sure. It's just your house talking to you, telling you how much it loves you and how much it's excited to have you along for the ride, however long it may last. All right, here we go.
This House is Haunted by Guy Lyon Playfair. This House is Haunted by Guy Lyon Playfair, Stein and Day, 1980, is the most riveting account of a poltergeist haunting that I've ever read. It is also the dullest. It's two opposite things at once in equal amounts. It's the story of the Hodgson family in Enfield, North London, who for a period of almost 2 years were plagued by an incredibly active, borderline malicious poltergeist. Whoever or whatever a poltergeist is, it showed up at 9:30 p.m. on the night of August 31st, 1977, and it came to play. Within the first 3 hours, no less than 8 people had witnessed strange knocking sounds coming from 6 different walls, both interior and exterior. 3 of them saw a chest of drawers move 2 feet away from a bedroom wall twice, and all of them saw a living room chair tremble violently and then shoot 3 to 4 feet across the living room floor toward them as they stood in the kitchen watching it. All classic poltergeist bullshit. And when I say bullshit, I don't mean I think the story isn't true. I mean that poltergeists tend to do the same sorts of things over and over. A lot gets made about how poltergeists plague families that are going through a large amount of stress, but come on, what family isn't? In this regard, the Hodgsons seem almost distressingly normal. From the beginning, 11-year-old Janet Hodgson was seen as the focus, and from the beginning, Janet was accused of faking certain effects. And in 2 specific incidences, she was actually caught faking. Well, there you go. It was a hoax then, right? Next. But no. The sheer massive activity over the next 2 years that author Guy Lyon Playfair and investigator Morris Gross witnessed and cataloged make it clear that there was no way for Janet or anyone to fake the vast majority of what took place inside the Hodgson house. The poltergeist experienced by the Hodgson family acted out in the ways poltergeists have for the past 1,200 years, knocking on walls and floors, moving heavy pieces of furniture, and flinging small objects around. The kind of stuff that makes you think the whole thing must be some kind of macro PK effect, unconsciously caused by someone in the house. In other words, a classic poltergeist, right? Well, no, there's other stuff. the apparitions of an old man and a small boy, repeatedly witnessed by some involved, makes the whole thing feel more like a traditional haunting. And the vulgar, growling, howling voices that seem to come from Janet, and later from her sister Rose for some reason, but not from their mouths, more from near their mouths, makes the entire thing begin to feel more like some sort of demonic possession. For long stretches of the book, it's unclear what kind of haunting is even taking place. And all along, Guy Lyon Playfair's voice, part nutty professor, part over-it investigator, part impatient narrator wishing the whole thing would either reveal its answer or shut the hell up already, guides us briskly through what for us would be the most mind-bending 2 years of our lives, but for him is just another poltergeist. And baby, he's getting too old for this shit. The whole tone of Playfair's book is this. Some impossible things happened and we all saw it. But then later, when other people popped by, it stopped. Then Janet did something weird that seemed genuine, but then she did something weird that seemed fake. Then a lot of time passed and nothing happened. Then I got hungry and went to the pub for a pint and a pie. And while I was gone, some really crazy shit went down. But when I got back, it was mostly over. Oh well, that's how it goes with a poltergeist. Even when Playfair and Gross finally present their case to the members of the Society for Psychical Research, they can't get no satisfaction. The more evidence they present, the more hostile their audience becomes. It's almost like the case is too good. There's no way this much activity could all be happening in one house to one family. Instead of finding support and encouragement from the home team, Playfair and Gross are weirdly excoriated. With no other alternative, they simply return to the Hodgson house and keep recording more incidents. Occurrences that would have terrified them all in the first few weeks are now simply noted and logged, tossed onto a heap of miracles, along with the rest, and generally ignored. Not because they're not remarkable enough, but rather because they are too remarkable to be believed by anyone who isn't seeing them at first hand. So, to review, the Enfield case is dull but terrifying, classic but unique, expertly documented but evidentially worthless, and real, but also kind of a fraud. How can something be so contradictory in its very nature? How can something be its own thing and its complete opposite at the exact same time? Easy. It's a poltergeist. A noisy ghost. The very name seems to announce its own inherent contradiction, like sad clown, civil war, or skeptical inquirer. The book isn't trying to convince you of anything, but I kind of wish it was. Playfair is so concerned with playing fair that he makes as big a deal out of all the moments he can't vouch for as the ones that he can. He takes us through every gut-wrenching setback, every news article that calls him a fool, and every attempt to gather irrefutable evidence that produces nothing but confusion and disappointment. The name of the book could have been Mamas, Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Parapsychologists. The house I live in now has been haunted on and off for the last 18 years. Hasn't yours? Hasn't everyone's? Susan was very pregnant with Dashiell in March of 2007 when we bought the house on Rosita Lane. At the time, we were still living on Queensbury Road, in the house I began renting after separating from my ex-wife Michelle. Susan and I knew that with the baby, we would need a bigger place, and we had finally saved up enough for a down payment. For once in my life, I wasn't afraid. Buying a house with Susan felt like a culmination, a final statement that said, "My old life is over, and my new one is now firmly established." I felt like the period of transition was over. It was almost 6 years since I'd moved out, and in that time, a lot had happened. The Mothman prophecies had come out, I'd written a pilot called Miracles that had been bought and shot and made into a 13-episode series and then had been canceled. I'd worked on 5 other shows since then. Plus, I had started dating Susan, we had gotten married, We had shared custody of Owen and Spencer, my two kids from my previous marriage, and we were now about to become parents to a new baby. Buying a house big enough for all of us to live together felt good. It felt right. And once my business manager told me how much of a house we could afford, I felt something else that I had never really felt before. I felt rich. This should have been my first clue that trouble was on the way. Take it easy. Don't get too excited. This was a voice I was used to hearing. It was my dad's voice. But here's the thing. I'd been ignoring my dad's voice my whole life. Why start listening now? Besides feeling rich, something else was coming to life inside me. I could feel it uncoiling like a snake behind my breastbone. It wasn't anger, no, and it wasn't revenge. My God, what a strange word to use. But it was vindication. I was finally undeniably and consistently working as a writer. I was in a great relationship. I finally had the career and the life I had always wanted. And I was 40 years old. I wanted a house. I wanted a big house. Something impressive. Something that people would see and think, wow, I guess Rich is doing really well. Even though we got divorced and Mothman wasn't exactly a hit and Miracles got canceled so fast the entire cast got whiplash. But gee, maybe I was wrong. Maybe the guy isn't a loser and his career isn't in the toilet. In fact, if anything, this house is making me feel bad about myself and my life choices. Rich did everything right, and I did everything wrong. Why can't I be talented? Why can't I be more like him? I suck. That's all I wanted. Was that really too much to ask for? We set out in early March of 2007 and began searching for the perfect home. We found it in 45 minutes. It wasn't the first house we looked at. It was the second. It was in a hidden corner of Pasadena, on a quiet tree-lined cul-de-sac that looked more like Northern Virginia than Southern California. And we had been wandering around inside of it for almost half an hour, going up and down the staircase and in and out of the bedrooms, and me falling in love with the office with the built-in bookshelves and a private bathroom all my own, and a living room with a fireplace, and a den with a built-in bar. All of this before we noticed the house had a swimming pool. There was a big backyard, but then beyond it, behind a black wooden fence covered in Carolina jessamine, its yellow trumpets in full bloom, was another yard, a secret yard, with a secret garden and a swimming pool, sitting there like it just didn't care. What the actual fuck? Susan and I burst out laughing. Could we actually afford a house like this? My business manager said yes. My agent said yes. So obviously, the answer was yes. We bought the house. My first idea was to add a bathroom onto the primary bedroom. Then we knocked a hole through a downstairs wall and created a doorway from the kitchen straight into the living room. Then we decided what the hell and tore down the wall between the kitchen and the dining room. Our contractor finally told us if we tore down any more walls, we'd Jenga the whole place and the house would collapse. During that summer, as we made such bold changes to the house before moving in, everything in our lives felt golden and touched with magic. Dashiell was born on June 23rd, happy and healthy. In July, I sold a pilot to the CW, and then a week later, I sold another to CBS. Two sales, two scripts, two paychecks, and two chances to have another show on the air? How could we be so blessed? On the day we finally moved in, Friday, August 31st, 2007, I felt as if we had entered an endless season of joy and safety and reward. It was 105 degrees that day, and we set Dashiell to sleep in his stroller in the shade beside the pool, and we took off our clothes in the walled privacy of our secret garden and swam in the pool and made love and then we lay naked in the grass as the sun set, and I felt the ground beneath our bodies so solid and secure. And I gazed up into the jacaranda tree towering above us, and I knew in a way I had never known before that I had done all the right things and made all the right decisions and could finally be at peace. Then I remembered the bottle of champagne that my agent had sent to congratulate me on the pilot sales. So I trotted through the middle yard and into the house and through the ice-cold air-conditioned living room and took the champagne bottle from the small refrigerator behind the bar and then dropped it onto the slate floor, and it exploded into a lake of foam and broken glass. For a moment, I was trapped alone in the house, and I thought, what the hell have I done? Then I carefully cleaned up the mess and disposed of the broken glass and mopped up the sticky floor until it was as good as new. Susan must be wondering where I am, I thought, and I walked to the back door and stepped hard onto a piece of green glass that sliced into the center of my heel and sent me to the floor, biting back a bright scream of pain. I slowly pulled the glass out of my foot, and it bled heavily onto the carpet, and I thought, I'm just like Bruce Willis in Die Hard. And then I thought, maybe this house doesn't like me. And then I thought, this is just day one. I've only been here 3 hours. What's next? To understand what happened at 284 Green Street in Enfield, England, we must first understand what happened to its chief investigator, Morris Gross, the year before the disturbances began. Gross had just endured the worst year of his life. On August 4, 1976, his 22-year-old daughter, Janet Gross, was critically injured in a motorcycle accident and died the next day. Morris was devastated. He felt like some essential tethering mechanism to the world had been cut, and he was now drifting away from his own life, a life that until now had seemed extremely regular, solid, and predictable. Morris had spent his entire professional life as an inventor of electrical and mechanical devices and held many worldwide patents. He was a problem solver. Now he was faced with a problem he could not solve. Or could he? He had read widely on the subject of psychical research, and he knew that sometimes the dead seemed to be able to make contact with the living. So he decided upon an experiment. London was in the middle of a record-setting drought. Morris decided that he would ask for a drop of rain as a sign from Janet that she still existed somehow, somewhere, and was able to communicate. The very next morning, Morris was shocked to see a small lake of water gathered on the roof just outside Janet's bedroom window, the way it would after a downpour. Except there had been no downpour, not even a hint of rain, and the drought carried on for another month. Somehow, Janet had produced much more than just a single raindrop. But how? Later, Morris would wonder if what happened that day was just Janet getting started. When Morris Gross arrived at the Hodgson House in Enfield, he knew exactly what he was up against. Although he had never investigated an actual poltergeist case, he had done his homework. And when he shook young Janet's hand, he knew two things. He must project to her complete benevolence and trust, and he must keep an eye on her at all times. Because according to all poltergeist study and lore, a young woman approaching puberty was the likely focus of the poltergeist. Morris knew that, one way or another, she was the star of this show, whether she knew it yet or not. He then did something very smart. He gave Janet's mother, Mrs. Hodgson, a specific job. He asked her to keep a journal of everything that happened, noting the event, the exact time, and the physical position of every person in the house. In an instant, Mrs. Hodgson was transformed from a passive, frightened victim to a co-investigator. Morris knew this would serve two purposes. First, It really would help him keep track of what was happening in the house when he wasn't there. But more important, it would give her and the rest of the family a sense of agency and hope. He could feel their fear lifting almost immediately, which was good. But he also knew it wouldn't really change things. Whether they took notes or not, the poltergeist was the boss, and it would stay as long as it pleased. Most poltergeist cases last about 3 months. He figured he could survive 3 months, and maybe somewhere along the way he would witness a bit of paranormal phenomenon. He didn't have to wait long. From the book, quote, "Within an hour of arriving, he witnessed more paranormal phenomenon at first hand than some researchers experience in a lifetime. The doorbell chimes hanging on the wall began to swing violently of their own accord. A t-shirt leapt from the laundry basket onto the floor and crept several feet toward him across the living room. Strangest of all, marbles began whizzing past his head while the children all stood still within full view. Oddly, the marbles never bounced. They hit the floor and stayed put, as if nailed to the spot. Over the next 2 years, Morris and Guy Lyon Playfair would spend hours trying to replicate this and other strange poltergeist effects with no success. Morris reached out to Guy Lyon Playfair, an experienced colleague from the Society of Psychical Research, and asked for help. And Guy, to his eventual regret, immediately agreed to help. From the beginning, the two researchers had subtle but clearly divergent goals. Playfair wanted to figure out a way to make the poltergeist activity stop. He'd already been in the presence of poltergeist phenomena several times during cases he'd investigated in South America. He was no longer trying to convince himself of the reality of the situation. He was focused instead on figuring out a reliable way to make it stop, which, after all, was the only thing any family ever wanted. But Morris was new to the game and was quite content to simply observe and record the shenanigans.
Hey, you guys, I am thrilled to tell you that the International Association of Near-Death Studies is hosting their biggest conference ever in Bellevue, Washington, at the Bellevue Hyatt Regency this summer, August 26th to 30th, and you're invited. This event is open to the public. We can go. And the theme this year is Expanded Lives, Exploring the Impact of Near-Death and Related Experiences. You're going to meet regular people who have had NDEs, and you're going to be able to talk to them and find out exactly what happened to them. They're going to have guest speakers like Dr. Eben Alexander, author of the best-selling book Proof of Heaven, Betty Eady, author of the best-selling book Embraced by the Light, and Anita Murjani, author of Dying to Be Me. She has one of the most amazing near-death experience stories I've ever heard. There's even going to be a screening of a new movie, a documentary, about NDE researcher Kenneth Ring, who wrote the book The Omega Project, which, coincidentally, is the next book on our show. He's a total legend. Here's what you have to do. Go to IANDS.org. That's IANDS.org. Click through to events, register, and get an early bird discount. That's IANDS.org. Look, there's going to be an exhibit hall. There's going to be a bookstore. You heard me, a bookstore. There's even going to be parties. Have you ever partied with this crowd? It's unreal. Guys, they've had a near-death experience. They're next level. They've died and come back. They have no fear. I guarantee you cannot keep up with these guys. Go to IANDS.org. That's IANDS.org. And get your early bird tickets for the International Association of Near-Death Studies annual conference this August 26th through 30th in beautiful Bellevue, Washington. It's going to be like you died and went to heaven. See what I did there?
In the fall of 2007, when we moved into the house on Rosita Lane, I knew all about haunted houses. I had for most of my life. I knew how they worked. Haunted houses hated it when new people moved in, and they hated being remodeled. So that was two strikes against us already. I wanted to feel immediately at home. I wanted to feel like I'd arrived at a safe, nurturing place where I deserved to be. But I just didn't. At night, I would often bolt awake. But I couldn't blame the house. Dashiell was a baby, only 3 months old. We never got more than a few hours of sleep in a row. He would cry and Susan would feed him, and I'd carry him downstairs if he had trouble falling back asleep. I got very used to the house at night. I was constantly on alert for paranormal activity, but the activity was all very normal. At night, I would stand at the built-in bar and sip on my dirty martini and notice how the darkness swallowed the entire backyard. And I would find myself thinking about that swimming pool, sitting in the darkness, unseen and forgotten, behind the black fence and the yellow flowers and the green creeping vines, and feel a strange aching sense of sadness and loneliness and fear. What bothered me the most for some reason was my inability to see outside at night. There were no streetlights on our block. The darkness out every window seemed total, like a black canvas bag had been lowered over the house. It was an odd, choking, suffocating feeling I couldn't remember ever having before. So even though it was only mid-September, I decided to decorate the front yard for Halloween. I wrapped orange fairy lights all around the fence at the curb and draped more of them on the rosemary bushes just outside the windows. I ran strings of large orange ceramic lights through the ivy in the backyard and through the vines that contained the fence that contained the swimming pool. It felt talismanic, like Halloween decorations always do. But instead of inviting spirits and devils, I was setting a perimeter and banishing them. If you're setting a perimeter, Rich, why are you stopping at the fence? Why not get up into the pool yard and put lights there too? Simple. It was too much trouble. So I didn't bother. Now at night, I could look down into the backyard from the bedroom windows and see a festive orange glow rising up at me. And it helped. I felt like beyond the simple purchase of the house, I was beginning to make it my own. Besides, I had never heard a single story about a haunted house that didn't like being decorated for Halloween. The Monday before Halloween, my agent called and asked if there was any way I could get a draft of either one of my pilot outlines turned in by the end of the month. I said maybe, but that was a lie. The truth of the matter was that with two projects to work on, I found myself completely stalled on both. I kept going back and forth between them, working on one, making no progress, and then switching to the other and doing the same thing. I asked him if the studios were getting impatient and bugging him to get me to actually turn something in, and he said, "No, actually the opposite. I'm trying to get you paid before the strike." Strike? What strike? I had heard quiet rumblings for the last few weeks, but hadn't paid much attention. After all, there hadn't been a Writers Guild strike for almost 20 years. My agent told me it wasn't for sure, but from what he was hearing, it might be coming, and it might be a long one. That's what I kept hearing back in 2001, I thought, but then nothing happened. So the way I saw it, I had two options. One, turn in a sloppy outline and demand payment. Or two, just keep working slowly and steadily and hope there was no strike and turn in the work when it was ready. I chose option number two. 1 week later, on Monday, November 5th, for the first time in 20 years, the Writers Guild of America went on strike, which meant that I was on strike, which meant that I was now morally obligated to do no guild-covered work at all. And since I was getting nowhere with my two pilots, I was happy to have some outside authority telling me to give up trying. The only problem was I hadn't been paid a penny for the two pilot deals I had made the previous summer. And we'd overspent on the house and the remodeling. And now we were functionally broke and on the hook for a mortgage that had once seemed technically plausible, but now loomed as potentially ruinous. On November 17th, the night before we left for our annual trip to Atlanta for Thanksgiving, I heard the house clear its throat and puke raw sewage up into our showers and toilets. It was horrifying. It was like the swimming pool scene from the movie Poltergeist, except it was inside the house. A plumber fixed the problem while we were gone and left us with a bill for $2,000. "Whose idea was it to add a bathroom upstairs?" he asked with a dark chuckle. "Oh, that," I thought, "that would be me." As soon as we got home, I snapped into action and decorated the house for Christmas. Multicolored lights replaced the orange Halloween ones, and it looked absolutely beautiful. But whenever I drove up our cul-de-sac from a long day of picketing and pulled into the driveway, I could feel the house sneering at me. Why did we buy a two-story house anyway? Going up and down the stairs 50 times a day was already getting old. We had never once dined in our dining room. It had slowly turned into a storage area for the boxes we still hadn't unpacked from the move last summer. And the swimming pool? Did we really need a swimming pool? I wasn't a swimming pool guy. We never used it. It seemed like the only person who ever went near the thing was the guy we paid to clean it. I should have felt proud of the house, like the lord of the manor. But instead, I felt small and stupid and guilty and burdened. I had wanted it to be a trophy house, but it just made me feel like a fraud. For Morris Gross and Guy Lyon Playfair, the first 3 months of the Enfield Poltergeist case played out pretty much as they had expected. But then the unexpected happened. Instead of winding down in the weeks just before Christmas, the Hodgson's Poltergeist took things up a notch. It began to express itself as a low, growling, almost demonic voice that seemed almost certainly to be coming from Janet. Gross had established a practice of continually challenging the poltergeist to perform more and better tricks. For the last few days, loud whistles and barking noises had started, always near Janet. It seemed unlikely that she was able to produce either sound. She had never been able to whistle at all, and her voice, unchanged by puberty, was high and very light. Still, why did the sounds only happen around Janet? Finally, Gross implored the ghost to speak his name. Nothing happened. But as soon as he left Janet's bedroom, he heard a deep voice behind the door sounding very much like an old man choke out what sounded like, "Oh, Morris, oh." Then he immediately heard Janet in her normal voice say, "It went, Morris Gross." Thus began the game. The voice would speak, but only when Janet was left alone in the bedroom with the door closed. Gross and Playfair would stand at the closed door and ask questions, and answers would come back, but it was almost always just vulgar gibberish. "Fuck you, shit off," that sort of thing. They asked Janet to try to interrupt the voice as soon as it began speaking, but were unable to ever hear both voices at the same time. Playfair remarks repeatedly that it seemed as if Janet must be making the voice herself. Later, the voice asks why women menstruate. And at that point, it doesn't take Freud to guess that Janet is either purposefully pranking the investigators, or at the very least, a part of her personality is expressing itself and its adolescent anxieties through the guise of what sounds like an old man ghost. Now, it's around here in the book that you start to wonder why these guys are at the house at all. Don't they have something better to do? Like anything? Which is, of course, when the old man voice starts making sense. He describes how he was the previous owner of the house before the Hodgsons moved in, and how he died of an aneurysm while sitting in a chair downstairs. Which was later confirmed by Morris Gross's son, a lawyer. Oh, sorry, solicitor. That one always feels weird. In America, when you're soliciting, it means something else. A week later, the poltergeist relaxes its closed door policy. From the book, quote, "After its initial coyness, The voice seemed to have no objection to our being in the room with it when it spoke, and we were able to get several close looks at Janet's face. We could see that although her mouth seemed to be moving, her lips did not form the shapes associated with normal speech. Gross managed to get it to repeat the phrase, "bottle of beer," knowing this to be a difficult one for ventriloquists, since you can't make a B sound without closing your lips. The voice managed it, however, without noticeable movement on the part of Janet's lips. Hey, can you guess what they did next? Yup. Quote, "We taped Janet's mouth several times. We filled it with water, and we even tied her scarf tightly around her head while she was wearing her tooth brace. None of this stopped the voice." Nothing weird here, folks. Just a couple of middle-aged men filling an 11-year-old girl's mouth with water and taping it shut because, you know, science. 2 days later, the voice made a remark which seemed to indicate it had knowledge that went beyond chance or guesswork. Morris Gross had arrived at the house later than promised. He said he was having trouble with his car, at which point the voice barked out, "Went too fast." From the book, quote, "The comment from the voice was immediate, and this could scarcely be a logical guess. If the car had gone too fast, why would he be late? What had happened was this. As it was a cold day, Gross switched on the engine to let it warm up, ticking over slowly and evenly, which it did for a few moments. Then, the engine suddenly began to race wildly as if somebody had put a foot down on the accelerator. It revved up and down as if waiting for the starting flag at a Grand Prix. Intrigued by this odd behavior, Gross spent some time examining the engine, and this had made him late. Playfair questioned the ghost, asking if it had been responsible for the malfunction of Gross's car, but it refused to answer. So now that we've proved that Janet isn't faking, guess what happens next? They catch Janet faking. Playfair had gotten into the habit of constantly keeping track of who was in the house at all times and where they were. One day, 4 months into the investigation, he clocked Janet and her brother Jimmy scurrying up the stairs. After just a few minutes, they came scurrying back down. Something seemed odd about their behavior. So Playfair went upstairs to check his tape recorder, which he kept going at all times. It was gone. It took him about 30 seconds to find it. It had been hidden inside the closet. When he played back the tape, he could hear the sounds of Janet and Jimmy moving the recorder and stifling their laughter. And when he came downstairs carrying the tape recorder, he says, Janet's expression gave the game away at once. Later that day, both he and Gross spoke to the children at length about the importance of not, quote, helping the poltergeist. And Janet immediately confessed to her crime. Why did she do it? Oh, because she's 11 and she's bored and she wants to see if she can get away with it? This stuff has been going on for 4 months. Also, a lot of weird shit is happening around her and to her, and she's scared, and people seem to be looking at her as if all of this trouble is her fault. So maybe she wants to feel some agency. In a strange way, maybe she wants to see what it feels like to do it, see if she can do it, and try to understand her relationship to whatever it is that's going on. Gross and Playfair seem to understand this, and frankly, anyone who's ever been a parent does too. So much of a kid's life is experimentation. Even when you've been told explicitly not to experiment. Maybe especially then. We all know if you're a kid who is accused of lying all the time, you'll probably start lying. And if you're a kid who's accused of fucking up all the time, you'll probably start fucking up. And why not? You're taking the heat for it anyway. Hundreds of pages have been devoted in other books to the subject of why children or adults who seem to have genuine psychic abilities are also often caught cheating. In the case of children, it's usually as simple as, can I get away with it? This, of course, doesn't account for the wide range of poltergeist phenomena witnessed by multiple people over the course of months and months. But still, I appreciate Gross and Playfair's insistence on telling the whole truth all of the time. And while it might seem to you and me around this point that they should pack up their circus tent and go home, it's a good thing they don't. Because on December 15th, events happened at the Hodgson House that remain some of the strangest and best documented of any poltergeist case in history. Too bad neither Gross or Playfair were around to witness any of it. "We don't have to keep the house," Susan said. I hated it when she said that, and she'd been saying it a lot lately. It had become her default response every time I said anything about the strike or how worried I was about money and how much I was feeling like my career was over. My assigned picketing spot was at the Disney lot in Burbank. I was stationed on Riverside Drive along the grass-lined sidewalk just outside the entrance to the ABC Executive Building. That was where, in years past, I had driven onto the lot and taken the elevator to the top floors to pitch and sometimes sell shows. It was where I had sold Miracles. As I neared the corner furthest from the entrance, holding a WGA picket sign, I could see St. Joseph's Hospital just across the street, the hospital where I was born and where my mother was currently undergoing chemotherapy. I turned around and continued my loop back toward the studio entrance. When I got there, a shiny black SUV slammed to a stop 3 feet in front of me. I stopped and peered at it, waiting for the passenger window to roll down. We had gotten used to people, even studio employees, sharing their support and sympathy before crossing the picket line and going into work. But this time the window didn't roll down, and all I could see was my own reflection in the tinted window. Then my eyes adjusted, and I began to see violent movement inside the car. The driver was furious, jabbing a finger at me and yelling soundlessly inside his insulated car. The guy was in a complete rage. Then I recognized him. It was ABC Entertainment President Steve McPherson. I knew him. I was friends with him, or at least on good terms. And now I was looking at him not 5 feet away, screaming at me like he wanted to kill me. Like I was the entire reason the union was on strike and the industry was shut down and had been for almost 3 months. Then his tires squealed and he drove onto the lot. At first I was shocked. Then I almost started laughing. It was so absurd. Then a cold vapor circled my heart. My career is over, I thought. I called my agent and told him what had happened. "Are you sure it was him?" he said. I was. "And he knew it was you," he said. Absolutely. My agent said, "Look, these guys are all losing their shit. They're sitting in their offices and there's no meetings and there's no phone calls and nobody to yell at. They're bosses, that's what they do. But with you guys on strike and all their shows shut down, there's no one to boss. They're all halfway to a psychotic meltdown. Don't worry, it's not personal." Well, it sure felt personal. "This guy hates me," I said. "I'll never be able to work at Disney again." "Sure you will," my agent said. "The day this thing is over, I mean the day it's over, everyone goes back to business as usual. We have to. You'll see. We don't have a choice." There was a weird sort of logic to what he said. I couldn't tell if it was reassuring or appalling. But either way, he was right. 2 years from that very day, I would be doing two projects for ABC. A pilot filming in Boston called Boston's Finest, and a 13-episode series filming in Shreveport, Louisiana called The Gates. Both would be greenlit by Steve McPherson himself. But that night, I went home and told Susan the whole thing. What if Steve McPherson really hated me, enough to hold a grudge, or even worse, a vendetta? How would I pay my dad back all the money he had loaned us and was still loaning us to get us through the strike? What if this really was the end? "Well," she said, "we don't have to keep the house." Again, I know she was trying to be helpful. I know she was trying to take the pressure off. But to me, it felt like she was saying, you can always give up, accept defeat, and live a diminished life, knowing you failed at the only thing you've ever wanted to succeed at, because you never really deserved it at all. It was the last week of January 2008. Dashiell wasn't even 1 year old yet, and Susan was already talking about wanting another baby. My mom was struggling through chemotherapy, but it was hitting her hard, and I was beginning to wonder if it wasn't doing her more harm than good. The strike showed no sign of ending. And when it did, would I be employable? 6 months ago, everything had been golden. How could everything have turned so bad so quickly? A low sonic whump shuddered through the house, and a cold wind blew through the room. The air conditioning had inexplicably turned on. It was after 10 o'clock at night. No one was near the thermostat. It had been doing this every few days at different times since New Year's Eve. Tomorrow, I'd have to call the guy. Since we'd moved in, life had turned into an unending series of phone calls to an unending series of guys. The pool guy, the heater guy, the AC guy, the cable guy, the ant guy, the roofer, the gardener, the plumber. It was like the house had started to disintegrate the minute we moved in. Dashiell started to cry. "I'll get him," Susan said. "You get the air." So I trudged downstairs into the dark and empty living room and turned off the air conditioner. At least I could see the Christmas lights still glowing gamely on the fence out front. Tomorrow would be the first day of February. I really should take the lights down, I thought. Then I thought, fuck it, I like them. Who cares what the neighbors think? Maybe I'll just leave them up forever. And just as I thought that, the Christmas lights all went out. Every single one of them. The entire front yard was plunged into darkness. You know what then, I thought? Fuck you, house. Fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. "You okay?" Susan called from upstairs. Apparently, I'd been thinking out loud. "Yeah," I said. "I'm fine." And so I trudged back up to the bedroom. And halfway up the stairs, the air conditioner came back on. You guys, my dream just came true. I get to do a live read ad for a product I actually use and love. I love Indian food, okay? It's probably, after like cheeseburgers, it's my second favorite of all foods. And I love meals that are healthy, fast, and simple to make. So I love the Cumin Club. Let me tell you what this is. These things, they come in packets. You order them. They deliver them right to your home. Here's the beauty. You just add water. You microwave. These things take less than 5 minutes. An Indian entree ready to eat. It is so delicious. Okay, so let me tell you how I do it. I started off with the paneer tikka masala, which is not overly spicy. And it was perfect for me in terms of spice level. But then I did a second one. I had it with the dal chawal, which is sort of a buttery rice and lentil dish. And I mixed them together. That was my dinner. So the next day I did methi matar malai. You know, I'm sure I'm pronouncing this wrong. My South Asian listeners, you're going to have to tell me how badly I'm mangling this. But anyway, the methi matar malai, it's sort of a sweet, nutty cashew gravy with peas. If you've had Indian food before, I'd say this is like a korma, and it's fantastic. So I did that one with something called pav bhaj. Pav bhaj. It's a spicy veggie stew. Again, not too spicy. You don't need to be afraid. And it was the perfect lunch. Took me 3 minutes. But they've got like 20 more entrees I haven't even tried yet, so I am working my way through. When I'm sitting here writing the podcast, I will suddenly be starving, and that is my danger zone, because that's when I will literally go into the kitchen and grab a bag of Doritos and just eat the whole thing. Don't do that. It's not good for you. It's not good for me. And that's why the Cumin Club is a lifesaver. Like I said, you add water, you put it in the microwave. 5 minutes later, you're eating it. It's a delicious Indian meal you can feel good about. Here's what you do.
Click on the link in my show notes or simply go to thecumanclub.com and put in the offer code RHPB. That's going to get you 30% off. I'll say it again. Go to thecumanclub.com or click on the link in my show notes and enter the offer code RHPB and you're going to get 30% off. Not on your first order, not in your first two orders. You're going to get 30% off every single time you order. They're going to deliver it right to your door. Eat something good, healthy, and delicious. You deserve it. You're going to feel good about it. The Cumin Club, authentic Indian flavors straight from the source to your door. God, what am I? I'm going to go have some right now. What am I doing here? Talking about it? I'm going to go eat it.
The house at 284 Green Street in Enfield is not a house in the way most people in the United States think of a house. It is not a freestanding structure bordered by lawns or fences or a driveway. Rather, it is a council house. Imagine a multi-storied townhouse or the brownstones of Brooklyn, and you're getting closer. The Hodgson's house shared a wall with the neighboring house where Vic and Peggy Nottingham lived. The two families were very close. And Peggy Nottingham was one of the first people Mrs. Hodgson turned to when the paranormal activity started. Janet's bedroom on the second floor shared a common wall with Peggy and Vic's bedroom next door. It's important to note this because in mid-December 1977, Janet claims to float through her bedroom wall and into Peggy's bedroom. Here's what happened. David Robertson, an investigator who had been assisting on the case, had spent the morning working with Janet. David's approach was to have fun and make his experiments seem like a big game. David had been assisting Playfair and Gross for a couple of months now, and he and Janet got along well, and this mood of playfulness that he established seemed to actually have a productive effect as far as producing phenomenon was concerned. On this particular morning, he and Janet were working on two separate experiments. One involved Janet attempting to levitate, and the other involved Janet attempting to move objects through space. In each of these experiments, David would leave Janet alone in her room with the door closed, and he would wait in the hall, listening at the door, and of course running an audio tape recorder inside the room. Now, to be clear, David did not expect any actual results to occur during these experiments. He was trying to create a conducive atmosphere for other spontaneous phenomena to occur that he might actually be able to witness firsthand. Peggy Nottingham dropped by the house just after one of the levitation experiments and was shocked to hear that Janet had not only levitated, but had somehow traveled through the common wall and into Peggy's bedroom. Peggy obviously didn't believe Janet had done this, neither did David. But in the spirit of fun, she asked Janet to do it again, saying that she would walk back to her house and wait for her in the bedroom. Janet agreed to try. Before Peggy left, she also handed a red pen to Janet and told her to draw a circle around the lighting fixture in her own bedroom, Janet's bedroom, if she happened to, you know, levitate up to the ceiling. And one more thing to keep in mind. Earlier, David had brought a large red vinyl couch cushion into the room and had asked Janet to try to psychically move it somewhere else. David chose a large couch cushion for this experiment because it would be impossible to hide inside the room. In fact, it was so large, Janet had a hard time even holding it in her arms. What happens next all happens in less than 10 minutes and involves two total strangers who witnessed events from outside the house. David steps out of the bedroom and closes the door, leaving Janet alone inside. In keeping with the game-playing mood of the morning, David has told Janet to jump up and down on the bed, an activity she enjoys, and one that helps him keep track of her location and actions within the room when he's outside in the hall. Peggy goes back to her flat next door and climbs the stairs and enters her bedroom. No sign of Janet. The room has just been cleaned by her and appears completely undisturbed. Then Peggy sees something. A book of Janet's called fun and games for children is lying on the floor of the bedroom. Peggy has just seen this book. It was on the mantle in Janet's bedroom. Peggy is stunned. Her window is closed, as was Janet's. And even if they were open, it would have been impossible for Janet to throw the book out of her window and into Peggy's bedroom window. Stunned, Peggy picks up the book and starts heading back to the Hodgson flat. Meanwhile, out on Green Street, the school crossing guard, Hazel Short, notices something strange sitting on the roof above Janet's window. It's a bright red couch cushion. The window is closed, but now Hazel sees something even stranger. Quote, "I saw Janet. I don't know if there's a bed underneath that window, but she was going up and down as though someone was just tossing her up and down bodily in a horizontal position, like as if someone had got a hold of her legs and back and was throwing her up and down. I definitely saw her come up about window height, but I thought if she was bouncing, she bounced from her feet. She wouldn't be able to get enough power to bounce off her back to come up that high. My friend could see her as well. We both could see her." At the same time, from a little further down the street, a local tradesman also saw the red couch cushion on the roof. He also saw inside the window to Janet's room. Quote, "I saw this child well inside the room, and I saw her head bobbing up and down, just as if she were bouncing up and down on her bed. Then articles came swiftly across the room toward the window. They were definitely not thrown at the window, as the articles were going round in a circle, hitting the window and then bouncing off to continue in the same height in a clockwise direction. If the articles had been thrown, they would have just hit the window and fallen down. The articles appeared to be books, dolls, and linen articles. They appeared to be traveling with considerable force, and all were going around at the same time, as though they were attached to a piece of elastic. The child then appeared on two occasions, floating horizontally across the room. At the same time as the articles were going around the room, the curtains were blowing back upwards into the room. The whole episode is very violent, and I was very upset and disturbed by what I saw." So while all this was happening, what was David experiencing? Well, as soon as Peggy Nottingham had left the Hodgson flat, David reminded Janet that she hadn't yet tried to send the cushion somewhere else, and he turned and closed the door behind him, but no sooner had he done that than Janet cried out. So he turned around and went right back into the room and saw with his own eyes that the window was closed tight and the cushion was gone. Later, Playfair himself, knowing that the window in Janet's bedroom was almost impossible to open, even for a grown man, tested the theory again and satisfied himself that there was absolutely no way for Janet to open the window and then close it again quickly enough for no one, either inside or outside, to notice. Once they were back on the scene, Playfair and Gross tested the possibility of hoaxing everything that had happened. The mattress of Janet's bed was thin, and the box spring hard. There was absolutely no way to initiate bouncing by lying flat on the bed. There was also no way to move any object from Janet's bedroom into the bedroom of Peggy Nottingham. They could find no reasonable explanation for what Hazel and the unnamed tradesman witnessed from the street. And finally, once they checked, they were all shocked to see a neat circle drawn in red ink around the lighting fixture on the ceiling. From the book, quote, "It made no sense to imagine that Janet, David, Peggy, Mrs. Hazel Short, and the tradesman had cooked up the whole story for our benefit, especially as none of these five people knew all the others at the time." It was early March 2008 when I found a used copy of This House is Haunted. By then the strike was over, and my mom had just made it through her third round of chemotherapy. Things were looking up. We had driven up to Santa Barbara for the day, me, Susan, and Dashiell, just to get out of the house for a while. It was a beautiful sunny day, so I spent it inside a musty, shadow-filled bookstore. And when I saw the title of the book, I felt like it was speaking directly to me. I bought it that day and started reading it that night. I guess I wanted to know if my house was haunted. But from the very beginning, it seemed clear. As far as Enfield was concerned, it wasn't the house that was haunted. It was the people. Was the house on Rosita Lane haunting me? Or was I haunting it? I thought back to everywhere I'd ever lived. The house in Monterey Park where I'd grown up, where I was haunted by my mother and her moods and needs, where I suffered what felt like imprisonment and dreamed of making my escape. The backhouse apartment on Lafayette Park Place where I lived with my friend Michael Grodner just after college, and was haunted every day by my inability to write and the looming specter of an adulthood filled with failure and humiliation. The house on Keystone Street where I first moved in with Michelle, that's where we got married and I sold my first script, and was then haunted by the creeping realization that achieving these two goals would not actually solve my problems. Glenview Drive, the house we rented in Alhambra, where I wrote the Mothman prophecies and fell deep into the study of the supernatural, and where both Owen and Spencer were born, and where I realized that my life was changing for the better and the worse in ways that were no longer within my control. Lake Avenue in Altadena, where even as we moved in, I couldn't shake the mounting fear that it would be a house of misery and guilt and fear and sadness. A house of endings. Then Queensberry Road, where I escaped to make a new life, but was literally given a curse on the day I moved in when my landlady told me the one thing I didn't want to hear. "This is a marrying house. Everyone who has ever moved in here has gotten married within 5 years." This scared me so deeply, I actually considered breaking the lease. But then I shook it off and told myself that it was just coincidence and superstition. I was married 4 years later. And now here, Rosita Lane, the house of reward, the house of security, the house of plenty. And from the day I moved in, the ground had given way beneath my feet, knocking me off balance, shaking my confidence, and bringing me to my knees. It was me. It was always me. No matter where I went, I brought a trunk full of fear and anxiety and unfulfilled hope with me and unleashed it into whatever dwelling I occupied. If poltergeists were simply the stress and anxiety of a single person inside a house, I should have had falling stones and crashing plates and overturned furniture and outbreaks of fire surrounding me wherever I went my entire life. Maybe we all should. The poltergeist that afflicted the Hodgson family, beginning in late summer of 1977, continued far longer than anyone expected. It wasn't until early 1979 that the activity finally seemed to stop. By then, Janet had been sent, for a time, to Maudsley, a highly regarded psychiatric hospital in South London. She was given a raft of physical and psychological tests and found to be perfectly normal. While there, outbreaks of poltergeist activity continued in the Hodgson house, but at a greatly reduced rate. She was the focus, but also evidently not. A report was given by Gross and Playfair to the Society for Psychical Research. It could not have been received more coolly. The people who were supposed to believe in the Enfield poltergeist didn't. The people who weren't supposed to believe in it, like cops, neighbors, and even some initially skeptical investigators, did. Guy Lyon Playfair always held that Morris's daughter Janet played a role in the disturbance, either as a literal ghost or at the very least a subconscious motivator for Morris. Morris rejected this theory completely. In a postscript to the 2011 reissue of his book, Playfair looks back at his 40-year career and concludes that the origins of poltergeist activity are likely not solely physical nor solely psychological. They are not spirits of the dead, but they might be. Or perhaps discarnate intelligences of another kind altogether. Or something else we haven't yet thought of. In other words, like William Goldman said of the film business, nobody knows anything. Do we know anything about the Enfield poltergeist? Well, there is one thing. The final, perhaps only bit of actual scientific evidence that emerged from the investigation. Poltergeist raps do not sound like normal ones, and they don't look the same when diagrammed visually. And by rap, we're talking about the knocking sounds that seem to accompany almost all cases. Quote, "A normal rap starts at peak amplitude and declines smoothly, whereas a poltergeist one shows an entirely different acoustic signature, rising to a peak well after the start, looking remarkably like the signature of an earthquake." The skeptics have one thing right: their constant invocation of the notion of cognitive closure. It's a human desire to arrive at a single, solid, unequivocal answer. This comes into play nowhere more obviously than in the study of the supernatural. The people who approach the paranormal skeptically retreat to arguments that amount to, "If it can be lied about or hoaxed, then it is a lie or a hoax." And with that, they have arrived at their philosophical destination and closure has been achieved. The people who approach the paranormal with a more open mind will often eventually toss together a theory about what is happening, hoping it will act as a de facto explanation of various bits of strange evidence. And again, for them, closure is achieved. Playfair seems perfectly happy to avoid both positions. He knows something is going on, but doesn't know what. No closure for him. Not ever. The door is always open. He sums up with these words: "Neither I nor anybody can tell you what a poltergeist is. I can only tell you what it does." He seemed to know that few things in this life can be neatly summed up and explained and put away. He seemed quite comfortable with the uncomfortable idea that a thing can be two opposite things at the exact same time. The following August, I sat in the backyard, the secret one behind the black fence. I was by myself that day. It was sweltering, almost as hot as the day we moved in the previous year, when everything had seemed set for success. I had decided to use the pool, as if by sitting in it and sipping a margarita, I could somehow claw back or at least justify some of the money I was spending on it. Anyone looking at me right now would envy me. A man relaxing in the middle of a weekday in his swimming pool at his home. Isn't that what I wanted? The appearance of success and happiness? How foolish was I? It had been such a scary year. My mom's illness, her death, the strike, the growing divide between Susan and I about the idea of a second child. This wasn't supposed to be the way I felt living in this house. There were good things too, obviously, all around me. Why was that so hard to accept? Why did pessimism always feel somehow safer than optimism? Or even a neutral, nuanced appreciation of the fact that a house and a life is never just one thing. I'd had enough of the sun and the pool and my margarita. I just wanted to go inside and retreat into the cool, cave-like darkness of my office. I climbed out of the pool and from this new angle caught sight of what must have been the largest spider I have ever seen in my life, hanging at the center of a web the size of an army blanket. I had almost walked right into it. I reached for the long pool broom and hoisted it like a joust. Then I heard a voice. No, don't. Leave her be. Susan had come up behind me. Are you serious? I said. Look at that thing. It's bigger than my hand. It's a rider spider, she said. Like Charlotte. Susan explained to me that this black and yellow monstrosity was actually beneficial to the garden and was also thought to be good luck, especially to creative types in general and writers in particular. Apparently, one of these nightmarish creatures inspired E.B. White to write the luminous classic, Charlotte's Web. The problem was me and my inability to accept ambiguity. The house doesn't hate me. The house doesn't love me. It's just a house. It is a trophy and a burden, a reward and a responsibility. It is the place I will live while my life plays out. And right now, in this moment, my life was good. So in the spirit of Guy Lyon Playfair, I decided that just for today, I would stop searching for a final answer. And instead, I would simply believe the evidence that was right in front of me all along. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producers are Tess Feifel, Sailor Franklin, and Harrison Marks. Our sound designer, editor, and engineer is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver. Our website is by Kayla Lord. And our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time as we delve into the world of near-death experiences and alien abduction experiences to discover the surprising things they have in common in Dr. Kenneth Ring's groundbreaking work, The Omega Project. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.